internet signal goes up to a device in my bedroom that essentially amplifies it and sends it to other places. So it's not the wireless portion. That's not a wireless device. That is an Ethernet device that works on a cable. So it could be coming out on the cable, but it definitely has nothing to do, as near as I can see, with Verizon. It's Ethernet and the Netgear switch itself. Back to Net.
Okay, that's a good piece of information there, Howard. The next person who signed in was Dave, and we'll pick up the others. Dave, what's your take on all this? What do the people in Massapequa think is going on? Into APG, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, hi, Dick, and good evening to everybody. I was very heavy into 10 meters about 30 years ago, and unfortunately, I'm not... Ready, active to get on low band at this time, and I don't have a Yagi antenna on the roof like I used to have. But that signal shouldn't be too hard to DF. You got a lot of low band operators around the county that have Yagis and stuff like that. Shouldn't be too hard. And I remember years ago there was always some sort of signal on the band that you could tune up and down the band, and you'd get a signal every 25 or 30 kilohertz. There was some sort of carrier you could hear, so I don't know if that has anything to do with it. I got a quick question for you, not on that topic, Dick, over.
As long as it's ham radio related, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, is there any sort of a pictorial guide to antenna types? And the reason I ask is because I'm always, in my travels, I'm always coming across an antenna here or there that I've never seen before, and I'm not sure what the antenna is for, a type of antenna, things like that. And I was just kind of wondering, is there any sort of a website or a book or anything like that has a pictorial guide to antennas that are commonly in use, today, if you know?
I've got an idea what you're looking for. I don't think I've seen what you're looking for. It'd be nice where you've got 10 pages where you've got four different antenna types on each page. One of them's a Yagi, one of them's a dish, one of them's a horn, and so on, with some words alongside of it. It'd be nice if somebody did that. I think it exists, but I don't remember seeing it. The sophisticated approach would be to get the latest issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Volakis. The fourth edition has more and more photographs and stick diagrams and whatever. Unfortunately, that's a 1,400-page book. You'd have to page through a lot of the pages, but in the process of you paging through that book, you're going to see 95% of all the antennas ever invented by mankind, at least the antenna types, and representative pictures of them will be there. So that's an expensive book. It's around $140. A good library, good technical library, should have a copy of it. And if you're a serious antenna person, you're going to want a copy of it. Once you see that book, you're going to love it, and you're going to say, I've got to have it. The only complaint I've got is that the fourth edition has so darn many pages. I think they've added another 30 chapters to the book from the original first, second, and third edition. As such, in order to squeeze it all in, they made the whole format of the book smaller so that all the graphs became a little bit smaller. And for a guy with older eyes, without a magnifying glass, it's a little bit harder to see them. But there's a simple solution to that. Let me drop it. Each time I come up to each one of my favorite graphs in Volakis, I hold it in front of a Xerox machine, and the Xerox machine is set in the 2-to-1 expand ratio, and I make a 11 by 14 or whatever. I make a larger version of the graph that's easier to read. That's one possible solution. The resolution is there, just that they've squeezed it down and it's a lot harder to see some of the fine printing. So every antenna type is in that book. But let's see if anyone else knows of a website or of a book which gives you a simple picture of each of the major antenna types, so that when Dave drives around, he'll say, aha, that's a left-handed people blitzer antenna. Give me your call letters if you happen to have some hints on that one. K2RIW in the TechNet. I was a little bit afraid of that. Yeah, that's a rare one. So, other than that book, I don't know what to suggest to you, Dave. I'm back to you for any of the comments. N28BG, KQLIW.
Hey, Dick, very good. And one other, just a little side note regarding the signal on 28.3 megahertz on the 10-meter band. The fellow was mentioned in the TRACON set up in, what is that, East Garden City, Westbury area. To my knowledge, and I'm not an expert on that, but to my knowledge, I don't think they do any sort of transmitting or anything like that from that location, you know, with regards to radar and stuff like that. I mean, they may have antennas that relay and things like that, but I think most of the radars and stuff that they use are actually set up at remote locations throughout the Northeast, and that's just like the central location where they, you know, they have all the radar screens and the operators, I believe.
And you've said it, but I forgot it, though, Dave. That particular TRACON center, what town is that one in, the one you're mentioning now?
Yeah, TRACON is located, I think technically it's East Garden City. It's on Stewart Avenue. It's just west of Merrick Avenue by Eisenhower Park. It's very close to that that new recycling plant that's been in operation with the big smokestack tower with the lights on it. Right by Roosevelt Field.
Good to know, Dave, and I thank you. There was another person who signed in with a further question or comment. Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW.
I have more information on the router if you're interested, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
KC2WGV. Dick, I just did a little experiment. I left the Verizon input cable to the router connected, so Verizon is running. I have the noise. I found if I disconnect the RJ45s, which are going to the network cards on the computer, the noise goes away. The antenna is still transmitting at 2.4 gig. I can still use the remote receivers RF-wise. It has to be the shielding of the 8-conductor RJ45 cables going to the network ports. That's where the radiation is coming from.
When you disconnect Verizon, the signal goes away. Now, what part of the Verizon are you disconnecting? The real Verizon cable leaving your house, I believe, is fiber. I wonder, is there a synchronizing signal on that fiber that synchronizes your oscillator? Or is there some other kind of RF interconnect between the box? There's a battery-supported box right at the interface where your Verizon fiber joins your house. And then from there on, everything is cabled. So what were you disconnecting, and what do you believe made the signal disappear? Now back to you, John.
You're right in your description, Dick. The fiber comes in, goes into a breakout box in my lab. From there, there's a piece of coaxial cable, RG58, that goes to the Verizon router. If I disconnect that cable, the noise is still there without the Verizon information going into the router. So I put the cable back. I disconnect the ports, the RJ45 ports in the back, which go to the computer's input cards for the network cards. So it's telling me if I disconnect those, there is absolutely no noise coming out of that box. Meanwhile, it's still transmitting, Fios is up and running. But if I plug one of those cables back in, which are not shielded cables, that signal slams right in.
So your RJ45 cables, which I guess are something like Cat5, and those are twisted pairs. Normally, they're pretty well shielded. Twisted pair cable, if they're being fed in the true differential manner, is extremely well shielded, probably 60 decibels or better shielding, even though there is no real shield there at all. If it's being used in a more common mode manner, yes, it'll radiate like crazy. So I think it's the RJ45 cables that you believe are doing all the radiating. That's what's going from your interface box over to your individual computers. So give me a confirmation on that, John. K2RIW.
Absolutely correct, Dick. So now what I'll do tomorrow, I'm going to use a short only of shielded RJ45, which is an 8-conductor. It's a T100 transmitting speed, I believe. And I'll try that and see if that eliminates it. And I'll probably talk to Dave tomorrow. I always hear him on. I'll let him know not to chase too much because it's going to be ubiquitous no matter where he goes, probably.
I think there's a possibility, John, because that is a quasi-digital signal. But 28 megs, 28.317 is one of the strongest components. I think various people have mentioned every 30 kilohertz. If I tune while your RJ45s are plugged in and you're doing the radiating, I got a gut feel there's going to be a bunch of other frequencies that you'll see if you tune far enough, particularly if you look with a very sensitive spectrum analyzer. What do you think, John? Over to you, John.
That's another great idea. Yep, I could do that. And, you know, this is going to be something Verizon may not be aware of. I haven't tried any other bands or even other frequencies on 10 meters, but you could be right. This could show up maybe at 29. I didn't go up that far. But good points. I will check that out.
Yeah, there are certain signals that I see in my house that I haven't yet done any bunny hunting on, which seem to repeat every 100 kilohertz in the 2-meter band, for instance. And I wonder how much of that is some of the netware. My son's got a whole bunch of computers running in my house, and so for a while people would drive by in front of my house and hear all kinds of signals and wonder what in the world's going on. It's the elaborate computer network that's got zillions of wires going all over my house. At one particular time, we had four simultaneous people using computers in the house. Okay. One last call. Make sure that we've answered everyone's ham radio type quick questions at this time. Give me your call letters if I've skipped anyone. K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay.
I do have one before we get into the deep stuff, if you can handle it, Nick.
Go for it, John.
I'm thinking about my HP 805. I have two of them. I want to put them in series. I realize the second one, I will have to change the metric scale because of the space between the two of them when they're coupled up. Will I be able to use that at half the frequency?
Okay, HP 805, I believe, is a slotted line.
Yes.
And can you, you said yes. The slotted line, can you cascade them? Absolutely. Because there's going to be a certain length of cable between the two, you know what Murphy's Law is going to do. Occasionally you're going to be moving the carriage looking for the peak or the null, and the peak or the null is going to fall right at the connector in between the two. That's not a problem if you're smart enough. All you've got to do is put a random length of cable between the slotted line and the device under test, and now all of those peaks and valleys get moved downrange or uprange, depending on how which way you look at it. So you can get around that problem. Can you operate at half the frequency? Absolutely. You could have operated at half the frequency or one quarter of the frequency by having a bunch of calibrated lengths of line. When you're looking for the valley, which is the sharpest thing you're looking for, if the valley doesn't happen to fall on your particular slotted line, and now you add an eighth wave, quarter wave, or whatever, you add given length of cable in between the slotted line, hopefully it's low loss, high quality cable, you add given length of cable between the slotted line and the device under test, you're moving all of those nulls in the transmission line system. Therefore, they will eventually, the peaks and valleys will eventually fall on your slotted line. So by adding other lengths of line, one single slotted line could go to essentially any frequency you want. I think you're the only guy on the East Coast I have ever heard of that is so well equipped. He's down to his last two 805 slotted lines, and one of them is mentioned, one of them is calibrated in imperial units, and one is calibrated in metric units. Wow. Over to you for a confirmation of that one, John. K2RIW.
And not only that, Dick, I have a third item for the slotted line. If you've ever seen the inside of a 545 Tektronix scope, they had a delay line in there, which looks like a piece of RG58 wound up. I'm sorry, a piece of RG8U. And they have these GR connectors on them. Now, the braid is silver-coated. There's no insulation on it. Now, I have an HP unit that has, I think, 18 feet of that, specifically to extend down on the 805. I had a problem with the connectors. I don't know if you've ever seen that device, but it works extremely well. I was telling Wesley about it a couple of months ago, but I don't know if you've ever seen that thing.
I'm hearing a very weak N2ZEH, I think it is. Let's pick him up first and find out what he's got to say. By the way, just give me your name and call letters and whether or not you're going to have a question on this particular subject before you proceed. N2ZEH, question mark, K2RIW. Zulu Echo Alpha. I'm hearing you considerably stronger on the input of the repeater than the output. Very noisy signal. So whatever you say with your question, I'm going to have to repeat it. Other people are not going to be able to hear it, Zebra Echo Alpha. But he's got an additional question. John, I know there's a delay line in a 545 scope. I didn't realize it's RG8. That's a big cable. Obviously, they wanted very low insertion loss. And it's a version of the cable without outer insulation, but silver-plated. Sounds like RG9 cable. RG9, RG214, these are both dual-braided cables where the outer braid, at least one of the braids, is silver-plated. Wow.
You might be right on that, Dick. I guessed that it was RG8.
Yeah, it could be the diameter of RG8, but it really might be RG214 or RG9. One of my favorite cables because it's got a dual braid, very heavy braid percentage of coverage, therefore very strong. When you put a type N connector on the end of that cable, you get a very strong cable. And it's got a polyethylene dielectric, which is my favorite when it comes to the jumper cable that you use around the rotator. I don't want to use foam cable in that location for a whole bunch of reasons as far as weatherproofing is concerned. So, I didn't realize it had a GR connector inside. In other words, that's easily replaceable subassembly by way of the GR. When you say GR, I presume you mean the Sexless type connectors that are good up to 4 gigs.
Yeah, general radio, that's it.
Okay, back to you, John, for some further comments on that. So I think you're saying that delay line out of a 545 is an easy way of shifting the nulls and peaks on your 805 slotted line. Also, you probably know there's a version of a slotted line that you can buy which is 10 feet long. I finally found something you ain't got. Over to you, John.
I have a 7-foot outboard.
Well, Wesley has one that's quite long. But the HP has a wire similar to that. I don't know if it's exactly the same because I never took it apart. But and they are both metric, so I will have to move that scale, I believe, because if I connect the two of them in series, I'm going to have a little extra length that's not accounted for. Is that correct, or I won't have to move the scale?
There's a yes and a no to that one, John. The easiest solution, in my opinion, would be for you to create a known visuar at a known phase angle where you get a null at a known position on both slotted lines. And now the shift in the cyclicity of the slotted, of the nulls on the slotted lines, in other words, you'll get a null on the 50 centimeter point on slotted line number one, and the second null you'll get at the 25 centimeter point on the second slotted line. Knowing how much spacing there's got to be between those nulls will tell you how much exact electrical length there is on the interconnect between the slotted lines. Therefore, you'll know how to recalibrate the slotted line that is further away from the load that's being measured from the device on the test. So therefore, you can therefore
mathematically correct for the length of line between the two slotted lines by way of their connectors, male connector on one end, female on the other, or a bullet, however you're going to do it, bullet and barrel. Or you could put a, I was about to say you put an exact length of line between the two. That would only work at one frequency. The number of wavelengths between the two is always going to be a problem. You're going to make that measurement electronically and correct for the one that's most uprange, let's call it downrange, from your device in the test. You're going to eventually find out by that test I just mentioned how much electrical length there is between the two slotted lines, and you're mathematically going to correct for it. Your handheld calculator can easily handle that one, John, once you see the principle. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Interesting problem.
Now, the other way I was looking at it, Dick, pardon me for taking so long, if I put a 50-ohm termination on the end of that, that slotted line works perfectly. So evidently, it's accounted for right to the end of the termination. Now, the next one is the standard input, which is also calibrated. So maybe there wouldn't be a need to shift the metric scale. What do you think?
Assuming that each slotted line is a pure 50-ohm device, assuming the interconnect between the two is a pure 50-ohm device, assuming that you put a dummy load on the tail end of all this that's an exact 50 ohms, now all the energy flowing from your signal generator going through the two slotted lines flows through there once and only once, goes into the termination, gets thoroughly absorbed, there is no reflected signal. So with a perfect dummy load on a perfect pair of cascaded slotted lines, there no longer is any peak or any valley. You got nothing to measure. All you'll know by way of the slotted line is, yes, the transmitter is turned on, the signal generator is turned on, because I'm getting an indication. But as you slide the carrier, nothing will change. You have no information in that case as to what is the nature of the reflected signal from the dummy load, because there is none. So that's not going to tell you anything, in my opinion. Over to you, John, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I'm going to try that with the dummy load, and then I'm going to give it a load of maybe 25 ohms instead of 50, and I'll try some different ones and see how it affects the scales, because they both read identically when I put them on the bench individually. So I have not yet tried to couple them up. I just wanted to talk to you first. But okay, now we can go on. I'm satisfied. Back to you, Dick.
Out of curiosity, how did you end up with a pair of 805 Hewlett-Packard slotted lines? The average guy, when he says, I've already got one of those, I don't have to buy another one, boy, the resources of these guys on Toad Hill, they're down to the last two slotted lines. How did that happen, John? Go ahead.
Well, about 20 years ago, there were two of them available. And if I remember correctly, I think I paid $100 for the two of them, and they were in the box.
Wow. 20 years ago would make it 1990. And by then, people were starting to heavily use network analyzers, and therefore a slotted line was no longer very valuable. Once the network analyzers became popular and well-calibrated, and the later ones become more and more user-friendly, a network analyzer gives you a Smith chart display, gives you an XY display of swept reflectivity, S11 versus frequency. It becomes very convenient. To use a slotted line to measure exact impedance, amplitude and phase angle of reflected signal, to know where to put the dot on the Smith chart. With a slotted line, it is a many-step procedure, and unless you're very smart, you can easily make a mistake on one of the steps and not know it, and end up with an inverted answer, end up with an answer that's crazy. So back in the days when we had to do everything with a slotted line, wow, to make a swept frequency measurement on one simple device was half a man day's worth of work. Nowadays with a network analyzer, if the machine is well calibrated, you just walk up to it with an unknown load, you've got a complete swept frequency response on that thing in about 15 seconds with a hard copy recording in your hand when you walk away from the machine. So think about it. half a man day's worth of work with a whole lot of slide rule operations in, let's say, 1960 became 15 seconds worth of time on the machine, and you walk away with hard copy with four decimal places of accuracy traceable to the Bureau. We've come a long way. So to be classic and go back to the early days, let me drop this. The slotted line is a fun thing. I'm trying to think now, where would I use a slotted line today where a network analyzer wouldn't be used? Okay, I can think of one. Assuming that your slotted line has enough tuning range on its probe where you can extract the probe way far out of its normal location, therefore you knock down the sensitivity, you know, 20 or 30 more dB, you can use the slotted line in between your transmitter and the real antenna, and you can put 1,000 watts of power through it if you want to. And the reason why you might want to do that is to find out, is the visor of your antenna changing at the kilowatt level because something internally is heating up, arcing over, or whatever. So the slotted line, you could run it at the kilowatt level. You run your network analyzer anything above plus 10 dBm, and there's a slim chance you're going to burn out the sampling heads and do some damage to the machine. The network analyzer could be used with directional couplers that have 20, 30, and 40 dB of negative coupling coefficient, but you need something to pad down the living daylights out of the signal going to the network analyzer. Other than that, I'm having a little bit of trouble thinking of how you would use a slotted line as opposed to a network analyzer. Maybe you've got another suggestion now on that one, and maybe that's why you are pursuing this, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, Dick, there's something you mentioned where you hit it right on the head. You can now go over and make that measurement in 15 seconds, which would have taken you a half a day, if not a day, to do. But you understand what the network analyzer is doing because you did it with a slotted line. So that's basically what I'm doing. And that's a great idea about the transmitter, too, putting it in series with the antenna. And I can put my spectrum analyzer right into that port. And my probe is retractable from almost touching it to about an inch and a half. So I can have a tremendous amount of attenuation on the diode circuit.
Yeah, you got to be a little bit careful now, though. The probe is not a pure probe that you put into a spectrum analyzer. If the probe and its rectifying network is doing its job, it's taking the RF energy, rectifying it, putting it through a low-pass filter network, a capacitor bypass, so that only the video voltage, hopefully with a 1 KC modulation on it, goes into the standing wave ratio bridge, standing wave ratio indicator, the 815, I think it was called, that you connected, or is it 415, HP415?
But yes, that's right.
Yeah, the 415 is looking for a 1 KC note after it's been rectified by the probe. Now, if you connect your spectrum analyzer to that BNC connector of the probe, is there enough RF energy left over after that rectifier for it to see it? Well, you're smart enough to be able to make a modified probe, which is just a pure BNC coaxial RF connection with no rectifier network and bypass, video bypass. Or, yeah, you can make yourself a very handy probe. But Dick,
the 805, the probe, the diode, is all built into that traveling head. Also, on mine, I have a variable attenuator on that. So I have a lot of attenuation, or I can have a lot of gain.
Yeah, but that attenuation is after the rectification, John. And it's not intended to give you RF feed-through. It's only intended to give you video feed-through from the carriage into your 415. Over to you, John. Wait for the beep.
Yes, when I feed my slotted line with a particular frequency, like 500 meg, with a 1,000 cycle modulation, I can adjust that knob and attenuate that, as you call it, the video signal at 1,000 hertz. And it seems to be very effective. Now, I have had it hooked up to my spectrum analyzer, and it works also.
What you're calling the attenuator knob, I think, is the RF tuning knob. If you're running a very low signal into the 805 because you're measuring something like a transistor, and you don't want to be overpowering the base or the gate input connection to the transistor, you therefore would like the probe to have maximum sensitivity. That knob that you're calling the attenuator knob, I think, is the RF tuning knob. You can literally tune to, let me pick a number, 1,000 megacycles on that probe by varying that knob. So I don't think it's intended to be a attenuator knob. It's a RF tuning knob. And when you slope the tech, yes, you do get less sensitivity. I wonder if you've got a confirmation on that one, John. And you probably have an owner's manual on your 805. It would be fun to read that section. Back to you, John.
I wasn't able to find my original manuals that came with them, but they're on the web, so I do have that information. But, you know, I should look that up and find out actually what it's doing. But I notice it does affect the video output, whether it's attenuating the RF2, maybe. Beautiful little instrument, and it works as smooth as a watch. The veneer tuning and all, great stuff. I love it. And it's a lot of fun, Dick.
I have a problem with it, Dick. If you have RF tuning knob, then you have a standing wave.
Not at all. The standing wave on the slotted line center conductor, the great big rod that flows through the center of the slotted line between the two plates, that has a signal coming from the signal generator going in the forward mode toward your load. If your load is anything but a pure 50-ohm resistor, a certain amount of signal gets reflected. The reflected signal goes back down that same piece of cable. The forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal do not interfere with each other in any way on that center conductor of the slotted line. The probe is a non-directional detecting, non-directional sampling device.
Oh, okay. So, in other words, John said that the probe by itself has a knob.
That's correct. The knob that's on the probe, I vaguely remember you can adjust the depth of the probe, which adjusts the sensitivity of the instrument, and you'd like to have the depth as far removed as possible so that it doesn't give you Heisenberg uncertainty, where if the probe is down there so close to the slotted line center conductor that it's almost touching it, then it's no longer a 50-ohm line, and you're creating some bezoar by the probe. So you extract the probe as far as you can and still have enough sensitivity. The probe itself is part of a resonant LC network, which when you turn the knob, if you're operating at, let me say, 1.5 gigahertz, you turn the knob until the LC network inside of the carriage of the probe hits RF resonance at 1.5 gigahertz. Now the detector network that's on that LC network inside the carriage gives you maximum sensitivity. So that knob is a frequency determining knob. I think if you take apart that carriage, you'll find that that knob is connected to a variable capacitor, air variable capacitor, that's across a inductor, and the network and the combination of the two is connected to that probe wire that goes down into the slotted line.
It's a large carbon pot.
Oh, alrighty, yours is different. At least one of the slotted lines I used, there was an RF adjusting knob. At least I thought it was RF adjusting. Huh! It's a real potentiometer. So it operates in one direction. In other words, you turn it clockwise, you get more signal out. You turn it clockwise, you get less signal out. And you didn't see a peak somewhere in the middle. The slotted lines that I used, I saw a peak somewhere in the middle. It was a real tuning network. I think there's various versions of the carriage. I bet you as you do a little bit more research, John, you may discover that the 805 slotted line had multiple kinds of carriage that you could buy depending on what year and what model number, whether it's an 805 C, D, or E. That's a guess on my part. With a little bit more research, you might be able to confirm that. Now back to you, John. K2RIW.
Absolutely, Dick, and I will take both heads apart. They come apart very easily because maybe one is capacitive tuning and the other one is a rheostat. Because when I looked at one to clean it, when I took it apart, there was a wiper that runs on this, what looked like a Bakelite semicircle, and which is probably flaked with carbon particles for a carbon pot. A very serious type of wiper, gold, and it turns around 270 degrees. So I'll take the other one apart and see if it's the same way.
With enough searching of the owner's manual on a late enough version, I'm going to make a guess that there might be more than one. There might be more than one kind of a carriage you can buy, because you'd like to resonate that probe to get maximum sensitivity out of it. Although there's a catch on that one, I see a problem. You think you're lowering the perturbation to the 50 ohmness of the line by extracting the probe. But now, if you re-resonate the probe, electronically, you're bringing it closer to the center conductor, and just like a grid dip meter, it's going to have more interaction. So the amount of sensitivity you get out of the carriage and its probe is a combination of what is the distance between the probe and the main line going through the center of the 805, and whether or not it's resonated. So at first I was saying to myself that I could get minimum perturbation by extracting the probe as far as possible, and then I can get the sensitivity back by resonating the probe. Well, when I re-resonate the probe, electronically I've made it closer and I've created the interference again. You see where I'm going in that one, John? You can't win for losing. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech test.
Right, Dick. You're right. Sometimes you can't. But as you know, as you very well know, anytime you're doing any kind of alignment or sniffing, you want to work with the lowest possible usable signal. That's like a rule, number one. That way you're not loading circuits and you're not distorting your information. That's what I found, and that practice works very well. But I will carry on the experimentations. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, please do that, John, and let us know what you find out. And when it comes to using the minimum perturbation, where we all learned that in the old days is with the grid dip meter. The grid dip meter has got an internal oscillating circuit inside of the head that you hold on to, which has got a frequency selecting knob. And as you turn that knob, you're generating different oscillator frequencies. If, for instance, you've got the coil that plugs in that turns from, let me pick a number, from 30 to 70 megacycles, and you bring that coil, the external coil, close to a network that you think resonates at that frequency. Let me drop. If you hold the coil too close to the network you're measuring, you'll notice that you get what's called a Adler locking condition. In other words, you'll turn the knob to where your grid dip oscillator is on the frequency of resonance of the circuit that you're measuring, but you'll notice that the depth that you get of the null is very deep, and it's got a peculiar kind of hysteresis to it. As you turn the knob clockwise, you get the deepest null in one position. As you turn the knob counterclockwise, you get the deepest null in another position. When you start backing off in the distance between your grid dip meter and the circuit that you're measuring, you'll eventually get a more gentle null, and now this hysteresis effect goes away, and the accuracy of resonance that you measure starts getting higher and higher. When you bring the coil of the grid dip meter real close to your circuit that you're measuring, you're literally disturbing the circuit. And if it used to resonate at 38 megacycles, you bring that coil real close, and maybe now it resonates at 33 megacycles. You get an error. So you don't want to be too close. So
I've noticed that, Dick, and I believe it's either due to added capacitance or maybe added inductance, but I think it's added capacitance.
That's an interesting question. Are you adding capacitance, adding inductance, resistively loading? There probably are different ways of making an LC network that you want to measure with different L to C ratios, which might have a difference in performance. Does the grid dip meter when it's coupled too close, always push the frequency too high? Does it always push the frequency too low for every different kind of LC network that you can measure? Interesting question. Huh.
I think it goes low, Dick, because it's overcoupled.
What is the distance of coupling?
Good question. When you overcouple a network, whenever you look at the appropriate curve that used to be in the Radio Amateur's Handbook for undercoupled, critical coupled, and overcoupled IFCAN, you go from a simple Gaussian-shaped curve when it is undercoupled, but it's got some extra insertion loss. When you're critically coupled, you get the minimum insertion loss, and the Gaussian-shaped curve has a little bit more of a flat top to it. When you're overcoupled, the curve of performance versus frequency becomes a mu-shaped curve. It's got a bathtub in the middle of it. So it becomes more broadband with that bathtub in the middle when you're overcoupled. So when you're overcoupled, you can now see not one peak, but two peaks, the left-hand side of the bathtub and the right-hand side of the bathtub, so to speak. That's part of the confusion that you get when you're overcoupled. Now, Wesley's question, let me drop. His question is, what is the right distance for overcoupling? And there is no fixed distance. If my LC network was something as big as a hula hoop antenna, a Saturn antenna for 6 meters, which has got a great big external field, I'll get one coupling distance. If I've got a tiny little network of a very small inductor and a very small capacitor across each other sitting on the table, on a wooden table, I've now got to be coupled much closer with the coil than the grid dip meter. So it's a function of the Q of the network, how big is the inductor. There's a bunch of variables involved.
The energy.
So what we're really talking about is, what is the distance that couples the energy? Well, I can be pretty far away from that hula hoop and couple to it. If the LC network on the table has a very large diameter coil, I can be, with a very high Q, I can be pretty far away from it and can couple to it.
What is the lowest frequency of grid dip meter that I could go to? Could that be within the range of kilohertz?
In the popular machines that are available, do they go down to kilohertz? No. Could you build one that goes down to kilohertz? Absolutely. But there's a catch. The variable capacitor that's built into it is probably a 5 to 100 picofarad air variable. And so when you build a coil big enough to bring you down to kilohertz, that small amount of capacitance, that's going to be an extremely high capacitive reactant at the kilohertz level. So you're going to want to use a larger variable capacitor.
Couldn't you use an audio generator, Dick?
Let me think about that.
Wow.
A detector, that's all.
I think the answer is yes. If you are smart enough to build a synchronous demodulator into the coil coming out of the top of your grid dip meter, and now you've got a real signal generator inside instead of an oscillator, and you're looking at the amplitude of the signal that's on that coil, and you've got it loosely coupled by way of a resistor going back to the signal generator, and you've got a synchronous demodulator on the LC network, absolutely. On the inductor, yes.
You might have a two accelerator instead of the oscillator at HDM. And I have a square wave shape that I'm trying to measure. Could I see the particle peaks and valleys? Could I see the most active components?
You guys doubled for quite a while, but with a single generator into a coil, could you operate down at the kilohertz level and get the grid dip meter operation? Absolutely. If you're now feeding that coil with a square wave, life gets complicated. See, the whole idea of a grid dip meter is you're trying to find the frequency of oscillation, the frequency of resonance. So if you're putting in a sinusoidal signal, your simple LC network is going to have one single frequency of resonance. If you're now putting in a square wave into your grid dip meter, which really means you're not putting in one frequency, you're putting in all the odd harmonics, you're going to get a bunch of ambiguous responses, so it's going to be more difficult to interpret. I don't know if there's an advantage of putting a square wave into a grid dip meter. I think...
No. What I'm saying is, I'm putting the sign, but the frequency of the response is square wave. I have a spectral component. I'm trying to dignify the strength of the spectral components.
If you want to measure the spectral components, tell me why you're not doing that with a spectrum analyzer. Back to you, Wes.
I'm doing it. It's just curiosity.
If you're trying to measure the amplitude of the spectral components coming out of a network, then you want to use a spectrum analyzer, not a grid dip meter. I don't think you can usually use a grid dip meter and get a rational answer in that situation. And by the way, the square waves, when you get them, are because some kind of nonlinearity is taking place. Either there is really a square wave generator, or a sine wave is being put into a network that is converted into a square wave because of some kind of a nonlinearity inside, whether it's a spark gap that's arcing over, or a limiting diode that's clipping, or whatever. There's some kind of nonlinearity that converts a sine wave into a square wave. And so you really want to make a spectrum analyzer measurement in that case. Now, because you two guys doubled, and I didn't hear what John said, John, why don't you repeat your statement? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I found that I was successful in making some of these tests with a generator, sine wave of course, the load, and a sniffer from the oscilloscope. And you can see where it peaks and where it's diminishing. So I think that would work.
Absolutely. What if the oscilloscope is a very high impedance probe connected across the network in question, and because the probe is so high in impedance, it doesn't load down the network and doesn't disturb it. Or you can make a poor man's equivalent of a very high impedance probe by putting a scope probe nearby, so you're getting a 1 picofarad or a 0.1 picofarad coupling coefficient. And now, by way of the spacing, you're making very light loading. And now your oscilloscope is looking at the response of the network at the same time that your source of signal is sweeping in frequency to find out where the network responds. And now you swish back and forth with the signal generator until you get maximum response seen on the oscilloscope. And most likely, if you do it right, that's telling you the frequency of resonance of the device under test. I think that's what you're suggesting. Is that right, John? Over to you, John.
Exactly, Dick. And to prevent coupling problems, I use a sniffer coil, and I bring it in close proximity, but not enough to disturb the waveform. And the results have been pretty good.
Yeah, that's a crafty approach. Now, let me give a little bit of an explanation for what I think has been going on for the last few months, or maybe it's a good fraction of a year. Wes has a number of people he's familiar with in Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, who have spent a good fraction of their lives investigating what's called over-unity circuits, OUs they're called. And there's a good number of websites showing sometimes neodymium magnet rotary machines, sometimes ferrite-type resonator networks with and without spark gaps and whatever. There's various kinds of fairly unconventional motors, generators, LCR networks. Fairly unconventional. Let me drop. Fairly unconventional means that when you try to draw a schematic diagram of them, what you call a capacitor really has inductance intentionally built into it. What you call a caduceus coil has an unusual way of wrapping its windings. Some of the windings are solenoid windings. Some of the windings are more helical-like or double helical-like, and with and without ferrite rods of various diameters. Some of them are coils wrapped around the ferrite yoke mechanism out of the deflection circuit of a cathode ray tube. So these rather unusual circuits have been investigated by a number of rather learned people, people with quite a bit of education, electrical engineering background, looking for the over-unity phenomena. Apparently Tesla had a number of articles, a number of financial backers throughout his life that were also involved with either wireless power transmission and or looking for other various phenomena where they were hoping to put, let me pick a number, 100 watts into a circuit and get the 200 watts out of it or 400 watts out of it and so on. They call that over-unity, where the power output is greater than the power input. Now, by the normal rules of conservation of energy and the normal rules of a lack of reality of a perpetual motion machine, the chances of this being real is very questionable. In other words, a high number of people will say, hey, you guys are wasting your time. This can't possibly work. Let me drop. You got to be careful with just simply jumping to the conclusion it can't possibly work. There's a lot of things in the world that people said, no way is it going to work. Can you make man fly? No, that can't be done. Well, the Wright brothers did it. Can you take a small amount of matter and get a tremendous amount of energy out of it? You can't possibly do that. You take a small amount of matter and you burn it and you get a little bit of energy out of it. And along comes Einstein with E equals MC squared, and he says, if you use this other technique, I can give you a tremendous amount of power and energy coming out of a very small amount of matter by using nuclear techniques. So, is there really over-unity? Many people are skeptical. I'm one of them. However, don't just completely throw it away. Wesley has been seeking this because he's got good reason to believe there could be something there. He's got a lot of learned people telling him this is what we've done, this is the results we've gotten. And Wesley's in the process of duplicating those results, making his own copy or getting copies of these machines. And Wesley is letting us know ahead of time. Let me drop. There is no absolute guarantee. Will this very difficult effort that he's on, a very long-range project, is it absolutely going to get success? There's no guarantee. Even if it's got a failure, very similar to Edison in the very early days when he was looking for methods of making an incandescent light bulb. When he wasn't yet successful, he was saying, people asked him, how's it going? And he says, pretty well. I know 3,221 things that don't work as far as a light bulb is concerned. And eventually he found a working mechanism. So in the process of investigating this, even if it doesn't work, we're slowly teaching each other real good techniques of being traceable to the National Bureau of Standards in the methodology by which you measure the total amount of energy over a period of time, the watts per second or energy joules per second or watts that you're putting into a circuit. How do we measure in a good, quantifiable, traceable to the Bureau technique? How do you measure the energy you're putting into a circuit? How do you measure the energy you're putting out of the circuit? What are the methods of measurement? What are the methods of analysis? What are the methods of making good schematic diagrams that other people can understand? So there's a big learning curve here, and we're all learning something. Even though it is a long-range, very difficult, dark horse project, we shouldn't completely throw it away, because only a small percentage of the people that sign into the TechNet, let me drop, only a small percentage of the people who sign into the TechNet have a sufficiently deep scientific curiosity that they're willing to investigate in this area. I can understand that. That's part of the reason why we do that investigation at the tail end. For those who really want to know about this and they're willing to wait a little bit longer, or if they can't stay up that late, they can wait for the recording on the amateurradio.tv website and therefore play it back in their tape recorder, so to speak, or on their iPod as they're driving to work in the morning. They can hear it as a delayed broadcast, if you know what I mean. But if you're one of those people that want to hear this subject, then we pushed it to the tail end because we know it's a limited distribution, desire of the people who normally sign into the TechNet. But still, we shouldn't throw it away. There's a learning curve here. That's my take on this. I'm going to pass it over to Wes and John for each of their explanations as to what is taking place and what they're seeking and what their definition of success is and whether or not we are, we're still going to have, we're going to get flack. No two ways about it. There's going to be people saying, you guys are crazy. You're seeking something that can't possibly have any value. Well, even finding out what doesn't work has value. If you've got enough perseverance to pursue the project and find out what does and doesn't work and how to make the measurements, there's still something to be learned, even for non-success. So in the big picture, you never have complete non-success, complete failure. You only have partial failure where you didn't quite fulfill all of your original desired goals. That's my philosophy on what's taking place. And 2XJN and then John after that is going to tell us their philosophy. You got it first, Wes. K2RIW.
N2XGN. There was a time when I was skeptic for many years and got across a few scientists that I employed in my office in World Trade Center 1, and I spoke to them and I started to understand their curiosity to science. Nothing that differentiates from American one. It is just a little different. The difference I would describe this way. One of the key of the success of United States of America is a teamwork. And that's what made this country great. In Russia and former communist country, there was quite a different story. It was hard to have a team. You had to work hours in closed doors and try to find out something, and you didn't have a equipment to measure properly. Let me drop. Therefore, what is unbelieved was checked to make sure that it's undoable. If you want to investigate that problem in the United States, you have a team of people, you have a good lab, you have a friend who have a lab, and then you can find out. It's undoable. Much faster. Then, there was Dick.
The time is 11 o'clock p.m.
Who I blame for this curiosity to arise to the level of experimenting. There was him who actually created that scientific niche for all curiosity, not only in me, I believe in many. I call him the father of my education in the United States. But this is not, absolutely not, my way of complimenting him. I don't compliment Dick. I just state a fact. I have $2 in my pocket. There's $2 in my pocket. I'm sure what I'm talking about. Then when I met another gentleman who was able to power his device for one single impulse, not the power from the battery, just for an impulse, and working in front of my eyes for half an hour, I was able to hold the device in my hands, to touch the device in my hands, to film the device, and being nearby, I've seen it. Yes, I flipped. That's okay. Fine. Somebody must be crazy here. Let me jump. And I came back. And about 2 weeks later, I met a group of people, as Dick said, with quite large engineering background. And we started to experiment with a few devices, two concepts. One concept was made 2 weeks after my return from TK, and the other one was another 2 weeks. So two concepts. Seems to be successful, although nothing is guaranteed. It might be a huge error, but if there is not an error, then it's a link that we didn't take into consideration. I then went to another trip to Europe. Six people were working, I believe, close to 5 days, 20 hours a day.